I wanted to write a book that, actually I succeeded, I think, in that when it came out, I was in California on the book tour, and I showed it to a friend who flipped through it, and he said, "Oh, you wrote this one in American." So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write a book about meditation practice and to have it free of jargon and be very plain spoken and hopefully accessible. I have a friend who teaches mindfulness in the public school system in New York City, and she was like my inner censor. I thought whatever I wrote had to pass her approval, because of course there are tremendous constraints upon her in terms of religion and languaging and so on, and she did like it, so I feel like I did it, you know, it was very triumphant. But the book actually, way past a working title, was called Why Meditate, because that's actually what it's about. Some of the science around the benefits of meditation and a real program for how to either establish or continue on with meditation practice. And I should say that for myself, as a college student first hearing about meditation, which is what led me to go to India, one of the things that struck me was the sense of invitation that was completely accessible, that you didn't have to be a certain kind of person, you didn't have to have a certain sort of background, that anybody who was moved to could experiment with these tools, and it is like an experiment, to see if the benefits talked about really came into being in their lives. And so I wanted, and have always honored that approach of incredible openness and accessibility. So the book was called Why Meditate. And then I received an advance copy of my friend Matthew Ricard's book to write a blurb, and it was called Why Meditate? And his book was coming out in September. My book was coming out the following January. So we very quickly had to find another title for the book. And the publisher suggested calling it Real Happiness. And I thought, maybe, maybe not. On the one hand, I felt that's great, because ultimately a path of transformation is about happiness. It's about discovering resourcefulness inside. It's about resiliency. It's about understanding the capacity we have to be free, whether we're going through a time of great delight or a time of great sorrow. So real happiness seemed quite appropriate. On the other hand, I thought, you know, people, so much of the time we tend in this culture, in this time, we think of happiness as something sort of superficial, like being happy-go-lucky. I don't think we appreciate it for the radical act it actually is, and the wellspring of being able to serve and take care of and try to help others that our own happiness actually is. There's that bumper sticker which says whatever, something like, if you're not depressed, you're not paying attention. But we also know when we are depressed, we don't have a lot of juice for connection to others, seeing whose pain we can try to address, because we're in some kind of energetic collapse. And so our own happiness from that perspective is a radical act. It's not something about self-preoccupation or just having a good time and ignoring everybody else. And so I was quite torn about the title, and finally, it was so kind of late in the day, I said, okay, let's call it Real Happiness. And then when the book came out, the very first interview I had, for very first media interview I had about the book, the first question was, are you trying to tell me that the kind of happiness I experience when I have a really nice dinner with my wife isn't real? And I thought, oh, there it is. And I said, of course I think it's real. And if anything, maybe we need to honor those moments more. We need to appreciate them more, be more present instead of so lost in some distraction when some lovely experience comes our way. We need to actually be here with them. We need to have more gratitude. All of that would be great. And it's also true that when we count on only lovely things happening, we're lost. Because the world is just not like that. There are many nights when we don't like our dinner. And I didn't say it, but I thought, there's some nights when you don't really like your wife. You know? I mean, that's just the nature of things, right? We go up, we go down, we're challenged. There's all kinds of stuff that happens. So I want to explore, is there a quality of happiness that isn't going to break, isn't going to change as we go through all these changes in life? And this, I think, really mirrors the Buddha's own quest, where it said that the Buddha was a human being and that the questions he asked were very real questions about human life, like, what does it mean to be born into a human body? So fragile, so dependent, so affected by others around. And to grow up, to grow older, to get sick, to die, whether we like that or not. And is there a quality of happiness that can sustain, even as the body goes through these changes? And what does it mean to have a human mind? Where, you know, maybe you wake up in the morning and you're filled with faith and then fear and then doubt and then anger and then joy, just careening this cascade of emotions that we don't seem to be able to stop through dint of control. You know, you can't really successfully say something like, well, I've thought about it really carefully and I've decided never to fall asleep meditating again. I mean, it's not to say we are helpless. There are things we can do to affect patterns and affect conditioning. But the idea that we will have supreme control, whereas everything arises out of conditions. If you didn't get any sleep the night before, if you're struggling with something, all kinds of things might make it likely you'll go to sleep. It's like saying, you know, I thought about it really carefully. I'm never going to be afraid again. I've suffered enough. I've grieved long enough. It should be gone. And so we say we cannot control what arises. We can distinctly and definitely affect how we relate to what arises. But it's almost cruel to have that kind of idea. Like, I shouldn't feel this and I shouldn't feel that and that shouldn't come up. So the Buddha, in effect, was saying, if this is how things are, that there will be these changing states, is there a quality of happiness that won't break, that won't shatter, that isn't so identified with just this cascade of change, so that it can have a kind of stability anyway? And stability doesn't mean unyieldingness and kind of tightness, but a real centeredness in the face of change. So at one point I thought it, going back to the book for a second, I thought, oh well, maybe it should really be called durable happiness, something like that, because that's what I was actually talking about, which I think is a reflection of what the Buddha was talking about, not giddiness and not jumping up and down and not superficiality, but that which sustains, that which can support us. It's about connection. It's about understanding, having a bigger picture of life, things like that. That isn't so based on the conditions that we find ourselves in. But I thought durable happiness is a really bad book title. Booksellers back there can tell me what they think. I thought it sounded like a tire sale or something like that, and that, then I began envisioning book covers with tread marks on them and things like that. And the word happiness itself, not just real, but the word happiness itself is a problem, as people do tend to think of it as kind of avoidance or superficiality and not opening to the tremendous range and depth and extent of suffering that does exist in this world. But actually, we are talking about that radical kind of resourcefulness. So I thought maybe the book should be called Durable Inner Resourcefulness, which is not going to happen. So that's real happiness. Also known as why meditate in certain circles. And it's been interesting for me, first being on the tour and then just talking about real happiness so much, because it has brought up all of these things. But then I think that's really good too, because we are challenging our notions of limitation, of what's possible for us. We're expanding and growing, and we're also seeing what we can access. You know, the world tells us so many things. It gives us so many messages. Many years ago, I was in Israel. I was about to teach a course there, and I was staying in Jerusalem before the course started, and each day I was going out into the marketplace in the old city, just kind of wandering around, and the old city marketplace is a set of very narrow alleyways with just teeming with life, with sights and sounds and goods for sale. And I was walking there one morning when I heard this merchant call out to me, and he said, "Well, I have what you need." And I stopped. It was like a thrill went through my entire body. And I thought, wow, he has what I need. And I just turned to go toward him, and I thought, wait a minute. First of all, I don't need anything. And second of all, how would he know he has what I need? But of course, we hear that message all of the time, don't we? I have what you need, and I have what you need, and I have what you need, and we just get kind of dizzy going for it. So the whole process of meditation, in a way, is just stepping back a bit from following all those messages and looking honestly, directly at our own joy, our own sorrow, understanding what underlies all of that and isn't bound to it. So it is like a very radical kind of inner resourcefulness. So I describe meditation, of course, for me personally, it has been meditation, by and large, that has been the path to that discovery. First of all, through the deepening of concentration, which is the first great skill of meditation practice. And these aren't, in a way you could say they're sequential, but they're also very interwoven. We're always emphasizing one or another of these skills as they form a unity. The first being concentration, and that is based on the idea that by and large we are fairly scattered. Maybe not in every arena of life, but for the most part we're pretty distracted. And you don't have to be an experienced meditator to know that. You sit down just to think something through. It's not long before we're gone. Our minds jump to the past, and oddly enough, often to a situation that now gives us some amount of regret. And we go over it and over it and over it, but not with an eye set in making amends, just to go over it and over it and over it, kind of fruitlessly. Or our minds jump to the future, and we create a scenario that has not happened and may never happen. And we're filled with anxiety about that. So this is my favorite example of that these days. I was teaching with his friend, Bob Thurman, who's a professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University, and we were teaching together in New York, and I just used this example off the top of my head. I said, it's like you're sitting in an airplane in New York City in an airport on the tarmac, and then you start thinking, oh no, this flight's going to be late. I wonder how late. I bet it's going to be really late. Oh no. I bet it's going to be so late that I'm going to miss my connection. Oh no, what's going to happen to me? oh no, that means I'm going to land in Portland after midnight. And I have a Portland thing, you can tell. You know, it's like, I'm going to land in Portland after midnight, and there won't be any cabs. It's not New York, after all. It's just Portland. I mean, what's going to happen? It's going to be, like, totally deserted. I don't know what's going to happen to me. And I said, in using that example, that when I find myself, many of you have heard me say this before, when I find myself in that kind of situation where I see the beginning of that arc of anxiety, in my mind, I have this, like, this mantra, this saying I use with myself, which is, something will happen. Something will happen, right? There'll be a bus. I'll spend the night in the airport. It's like Portland isn't famous for people vanishing after midnight. Something will happen. I can't figure it out right now. So the reason I said in the beginning that I used this example in front of Bob was because maybe 6 weeks after that class, I got an email from him which said simply, just landed in Portland. Lots of cabs. You know, but our minds create these things, you know. So that's what we discover. We sit down to feel the breath or to think something through or work something out. Our minds go to the past, go to the future, jumping. So what we do in the process of deepening concentration is we gather. It's like we take all that energy, all that scattered attention, we gather it together around an object. It doesn't have to be the breath, it could really be anything. It could be a mantra, visualization, image, prayer, sound. We tend, as I said, in the tradition of practice I come from, to use something like the breath for a number of different reasons. One, as my first teacher said, you don't have to believe anything in order to feel your breath. You don't have to call yourself a Buddhist or a Hindu or reject anything else. If you're breathing, you can be meditating. And then, as he said, and I've always found this quite charming, he said, the breath is very portable. So here we are, we're in a meditation class. It's designed so that we are practicing meditation together. We can also practice wherever we are. Maybe you're at that contentious meeting at work, and tempers are starting to flare. You don't have to say, excuse me a minute, and open up the closet door and pull out all this equipment, you know, and sit down and look weird. You're breathing. You're in touch. So whether it's the breath or the body or sound, something, it's a very useful kind of object as that gathering point. But whatever the gathering point is, this is what we do. It's like we take all that energy and we bring it together. So concentration is, first of all, considered the path of power within Buddhist traditions, because that's a lot of energy that could be available to us but generally isn't, because it's just flying all over the place. And as we gather over time, it does become available to us, and we are empowered by that. And it's also considered a path of healing, because the kind of larger manifestation of that scatteredness, that distractedness, is a sense of fragmentation. It's the way we have so much role division in our life, so much compartmentalization, where people say, I feel like I'm one person at work and another person at home. Or my favorite example of that was teaching a class in New York City once, and someone raised her hand and she said, I'm filled with loving kindness and compassion for all beings everywhere as long as I'm alone. But once I'm with others is really rough. Or it could be the other way around. We could feel fine when we're with others, but very ill at ease being alone. So our lives are also very cut apart. And we bring it all together in that gathering. All those aspects of ourselves, all those disparate parts of ourselves, we bring it together. So it's a movement toward integration, toward wholeness of our being, toward cohesiveness, toward centeredness, and that's healing. So that's the power of concentration. The second great skill of meditation is mindfulness. It's the ability, cultivating the ability, to be aware of what our experience is without so many stories, so many preconceptions, so many assumptions, so many judgments, so much bias, distorting what we're actually perceiving. It's not that all that stuff doesn't come up, but it doesn't have to be taken to heart. We don't have to absorb it, get lost in it. We can more see things the way they are. I did an interview today on the phone with somebody writing an article about meditation and art. He told me, which I hadn't known, he said that there are a growing number of museums that are holding meditation classes, which I thought was really fascinating, isn't it? And seeing how people then view the art differently, perhaps, because of the meditation class they were doing. So he asked me what I thought about it. And I use this quotation, which my friend Mark Epstein has used. It's not like a literal quotation. It's sort of this paraphrase from James Joyce, but it does exist in his writings. Which is something like he's suggesting how one should view art. And he said, James Joyce said, if you hold it too close, it becomes pornography. And if you stand too far away, it becomes criticism. So the way you should look at art is to behold it. And often when Mark and I are teaching together, and Mark will use that comment, I'll say, that's what we mean by mindfulness. It's a certain spatial relationship to experience. We're not kind of grabbing it and like pulling it in toward us, trying to claim it or own it. And we're also not standing far back, too far back, being kind of cold or disdainful. We want to behold our experience, internal and external. Mindfulness is also considered a path to healing because it's a quality of relationship that can go anywhere. It's how we started when I said what comes up in the meditation is not so important. What really matters is how we are with what comes up in the meditation. So maybe it was joy, maybe it was sleepiness, maybe it was boredom, maybe it was ecstasy. It's kind of not the point. In some way, that could be a tremendous relief as we spend the rest of the day trying to get something great to happen. It's almost like the greatness is there anyway, if the relationship is right. Even if what we're looking at is conventionally felt to be a kind of difficult state, unwelcome state, whatever it might be, because we're with it in a certain way, everything changes. So we say mindfulness doesn't take the shape of what it's watching. Mindfulness can go anywhere. Because what we're working is to behold our experience. So we have a certain feeling of freedom. And most importantly, mindfulness is considered the platform for wisdom or understanding or insight. Because if something comes up, say a certain emotion comes up in our experience and we're struggling against it and we hate it and we want it to go away all the time, there's not going to be a lot of learning going on. But at the same time, if we are overcome by it, enveloped, defined by that emotional state, there's not going to be quite enough space for there to be a lot of learning to go on. So mindfulness is the platform for insight. That's its most important function. It's being with anything in a way that opens us to a much deeper experience of our lives. And then the third great skill is loving kindness or compassion, which of course exists both as a very distinct meditative tradition with its own methodology, which we'll also go into this weekend, as well as concentration and mindfulness. But at the same time, as a quality, I really believe things like loving kindness and compassion are developed even if you're doing any old meditation practice. If you're not necessarily doing the ones that are especially designed for those states. Because inevitably they have to be. It's like if you just go back to what we did in that meditation, maybe you felt a few breaths, most likely your attention then wandered, you went somewhere else. And just think for a few moments of that moment when you realized, oh, it's been quite some time since I last felt a breath. What do we usually do in that moment? Most commonly, it's something like, I'm an idiot. I can't believe I was thinking. Why was I thinking? No one else in the room is thinking. They're all sitting here in bliss. They're all sitting here bathed in brilliant white light. Maybe they're beyond white light. You know, they're not thinking. I'm the only one who's thinking. I'm so bad. I'm so awful. I'm so stupid. I'm so terrible. Well, maybe they are thinking, but they're thinking beautiful thoughts. They're thinking wonderful thoughts. They're thinking spiritual thoughts. I'm the only one who's sitting here thinking about the bridges in Seattle. Why am I thinking about the bridges in Seattle? I'm not responsible for the bridges in Seattle. Anyway, I worked it all out last time I was sitting, you know. Why am I thinking about it again? I'm so stupid. I'm so bad. Right? That's what we tend to do. And so in falling into that pattern, not only are we adding sometimes a considerable amount of time to the length of the distraction, but it's so exhausting. It's so demoralizing, all of that judgment. It's a pretty big thing to let go, bring our attention back in kindness, in compassion for ourselves. And in fact, it's the only way we can begin again, is through the extension of greater loving kindness and compassion to ourselves. Otherwise, we just fall into that habit, inevitably, for a good long time. So that's why I say, even if it's never spoken, even if it's never articulated, we are deepening and developing those qualities of loving kindness and compassion. So whatever method, and some of the methods are extremely simple. These are the three things that we're doing, and it's all about attention, which is the basis for happiness. The deepening of concentration will help stabilize our attention. Mindfulness will help, you could say, clarify our attention so it's not so cluttered with all those old habits of holding on and pushing away. And loving kindness and compassion will actually open our attention. And certainly the techniques of loving kindness meditation are about inclusion rather than exclusion. They're about noticing the ways that our attention can be really constricted, like maybe in thinking about yourself, you pretty well only think about the things you don't like. And so we open just to see what it's like to include more elements of our experience, or just going through a day. A very profound question is, who do we pay attention to? Who do we look right through? Who do we ignore? Who becomes the other, not even through prejudice or antipathy, but just indifference? And what happens if we open? If we actually pay attention to those we usually look right through? If we include rather than exclude? So that's the exercise of loving kindness. And as we do each of these things in molding and clarifying and transforming our power of attention, we experience access to a quality of happiness that is very different from the ordinary meaning, because it is about inner resourcefulness and stability and clarity and connection and openness and caring. And that is something that can go with us absolutely everywhere. So, do you have any questions or comments? Anything you want to talk about? We have a microphone for you, and I assume someone who, out of the goodness of their heart, will run around with it. About her grandfather dying. He's in the process of dying, and I'll probably pass away in just a few days, and what are my thoughts about that? So, you know, I have thoughts in a lot of different levels, also based on my own conditioning, and every side, my personal conditioning is as a human being, and also my many, many years of being immersed in a Buddhist culture, you know, with a certain perspective around that. I think in terms of general Western culture, we have a lot to bear because death is considered something kind of put aside. And I know, like, my mother died when I was 9 years old, and the nature of my family, of course, as well as a more general kind of environment, you know, where it just wasn't talked about, that was not really considered right or helpful in some very odd sort of way. And you certainly see that in kind of the larger culture as well, where not only dying, but getting older, not having control all the time, something like that is really considered sort of off-putting, like it shouldn't happen. And so I think we're challenged by that message as we are with that process, which is obviously inevitable and natural. It's not aberrant. And because of that message, that larger message, the tendency is to really feel more isolated, when actually these are the things that should bring us all together. We should feel a tremendous sense of connection with one another, because this is what we all face, both personally and in terms of those we love and care about. We should be taking care of each other more, because of that vulnerability to change, that is the truth of life. My Buddhist conditioning is very much, and this of course is a belief system which not everyone shares, is very much around the idea of rebirth, and that is believed very strongly in Buddhist culture, that even after someone dies, because it's felt that they are reborn somewhere, that there's a very viable and powerful connection that can happen beyond the body, beyond space and time, and that's through one's good-heartedness. That when we do something toward the good, when we're kind, when we help somebody, when we meditate, even if it feels like your meditation is like completely crummy, you know, the fact that you sat down to do it is considered to have a kind of moral force. And very classically, that sense of goodness, the power of that, is dedicated to those who've helped us, to those who've died, and so on. And, you know, so I've been really in that kind of structure of that belief system for like 40 years now. And so it's just a part of the way I see the world. And whether it's that exactly or not, you know, I think that's a very potent time. In terms of the actual dying process, one thing the Buddha said was remind people of the good that they've done. Because right there in that time, it's a very powerful connection of kind of the joy of life. And so not that there's a right or wrong thing to do ever, I think, but especially not then, but it's something that I have done with people, and it feels like it's a good and appropriate kind of connection to make in that process. Which is a country I've done some practice in, where there's a tremendous respect for the power of generosity. There's a tremendous regard for the power of generosity. So For example, in Burma, on your birthday, you don't expect to get gifts, you expect to give gifts. That's how you celebrate. Many of the monasteries and the retreat centers don't have a fee, even for room and board, because everything that a meditator would need is provided by people. An individual, a family, sometimes a whole village will come together to offer a meal. And very commonly when someone has died, the family will come together, they'll come to the monastery and they'll offer food for everybody in honor of the person who has died. And that's the way they're commemorated, and they dedicate the power, the merit of that action to the person who's died. And so it's also something that's quite beautiful with good action to really dedicate that and offer it in that way. Okay. It's a cosmology, and within that cosmology, I mean, it's a whole intricate metaphysical system, which many people, even very devoted to the meditative techniques, are not interested in or particularly drawn to or believe in, whereas for others it kind of makes sense. And so and I think it's useful in a few different ways. Potentially, there's first of all, they say time is beginningless, and so from beginningless time, each of us, they say, have died and been reborn and died and been reborn and died and been reborn. So first of all, that takes away some of the performance anxiety. You know, I haven't had to do this. It's like, you've done it. It's okay. Within the course of these many lifetimes, it's said we've all done everything. So that those of us sitting here in this room together right now have all been one another's friends and enemies. We've helped one another. We've hurt one another. Because it's beginningless time, right? And so we're all trailing this infinite number of previous lifetimes. And I've often thought from within that perspective, the single most illogical kind of feeling one could have is a feeling of self-righteousness. You know, like I, who am so perfect and immaculate way over here, am looking at you way over there, who's done this terrible thing which I could never ever do, because guess what? You've done it. You know, so there are certain ways in which that belief system can really be liberating in terms of how we might utilize it. And of course, there are lots of other ways of getting to those same understandings without the belief system. So in terms of that last, for example, I've often said, and we may be getting closer, I've often said I wanted someone to invent some machine that can amplify people's thoughts. And every once in a while I read something and I think, I need Tucker to explain it to me. I think we're getting closer, you know, doing things with the brain. That's kind of eerie. Because then I think, well, what we could do is in some meditation session, if there were such a machine, we could just plug someone in and the rest of us could listen as this one person's thoughts are amplified, and that would be fun, wouldn't it? And you think, wow, you look so serene. What? Look what was going on in there. Because we're not so different. And in the absence of that machine, I think it doesn't take that much introspection. You know, we can look in somebody and say, oh, I wouldn't act that way. But to say I would never feel that, unlikely. I would never feel that much greed, that much fear, that much anger, whatever it might be, because we see the range of what actually arises inside of us. And maybe we wouldn't act that way because we have better means of dealing with our feelings. We have more awareness. We have different background. We have more training. Sometimes it's really sheer good luck. I bet everyone in this room could look back at some time where we now think, thank goodness the phone rang, or I went there instead of there because I was really close to making a really bad mistake. You know, so that same sensibility one gets through reflecting on, say, all those many lives can be gotten a lot of different ways. And so, the cosmology isn't held necessarily as being so important to investigate. But it's kind of interesting, you know, doing that. Uh-huh. So the comment was about how much terrible suffering there really is existing in this world. And then when we talk about happiness, sometimes it does seem like being in a fantasy world or being really cut off. So how do we put that together? And, you know, that's a very crucial question. And having just spent 12 days with the Dalai Lama, you know, where that kind of comes up quite a lot. And it's interesting, he always says, oh, I'm very hopeful. And you think about that, 50 years in exile, there's a lot. But the nature of that happiness, I think, is something that is about resourcefulness. It's about some connection, even to how much we don't know. You know, some bigger picture. Because when we think what we see in front of us is the end of the story, it can be tremendously discouraging. But when we understand that what we see in front of us is part of something we don't yet know, really, how it will unfold, then there's a very different feeling inside. And so I think it would be crazy to imply one never gets overcome by the suffering, by the difficulty, by the pain. But on almost on a kind of practical level, you know, we ask, well, if you're kind of perpetually overcome, you don't have any energy to actually try to make a change or have an effect or contribute something, however small it might seem. And what seems small may not be small, in fact, as our actions ripple out and continue to have an effect. And so I always come back to that sense of happiness as something around connection, inclusion, and a much bigger picture of life. You know, if our deepest sense of happiness is just pleasure, then we're definitely in trouble. Because not only do we cling to the pleasure that comes our way, even though by its very nature it's impermanent, we also resent the suffering that other people may be revealing to us because we don't want to be bothered. You know, we want to keep that pleasure intact and we don't want that unpleasant sight of whatever or that reminder. I mean, I have a woman who came to see me who'd had a really terrible tragedy in her life and not that long before. It was maybe 6 months before, something like that. And part of what was causing her immediate suffering, besides the terrible thing that had happened, was that her friends were kind of saying to her, well, you know, it's time to get over it, like move on. And the way she put it was, she said, my friends have golden lives. Nothing ever goes wrong, which I personally didn't believe for a moment, but a lot can happen behind closed doors. But anyway, this was the presentation, and she said, they don't like me around because I represent, you know, this terrible thing which has happened, and they don't want it. They don't want to be confronted with that because their lives are perfect. And I had one of those experiences, you know, where you just hear these words come out of your mouth. So what I heard come out of my mouth was, I think you need new friends. I said, you should meet my friends. They're all a wreck. Everybody's got something wrong going on. And sometimes I say that with friends in the room. But it's not that they're all a wreck, really falling apart. But, you know, when we're honest, there's a lot going on in life. And rather than feeling, oh, I have to hide that and isolate myself and isolate you because you're disturbing me, you know, we can have a very different sense about life and one another and what we share, and that's its own kind of happiness, which is much stronger because it's durable. You know, if we're like just holding on to pleasure and trying to push away pain, our own and others, then our world gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and we're afraid all the time, and it's not a very happy state. There were 15,000 of us. It wasn't that intimate, you know, a scene. It was like, he was doing a series of teachings and this particular ritual called the Kala Chakra, which is the Wheel of Time. And in the course of the 12 days, he was doing his own practice. So the first few days were really interesting because there was no exposition, there was no discourse. He was doing his practice up on the stage, and if you were there, you could practice too. So it was kind of like doing your daily meditation with Dalai Lama. And then he gave talks for several days. And this whole time, these monks are constructing a mandala, you know, a sand mandala. It's very intricate wheel, you know, like piece of art made of sand, colored sand. So, and then there were several days of ritual. And then at the end of that, the sand mandala is like smushed together. So it comes into being and then it dissolves like time. And so the last thing that happened was that the mandala was dissolved, and they took it and put it in the river. And so it was really a fantastic series of days, you know, and it was a long time, so it was quite great. And with all these things, whether it's a retreat, even like this weekend, or a longer residential retreat, just that kind of one-pointedness is interesting. You know, where you may not be checking your email every 15 minutes or whatever it might be that one ordinarily does. And it's so interesting just entering a dimension of dedication and devotion for a period of time. And then going back, of course, is very interesting too. It's like turning on the TV because you're not getting up at 6 in the morning and, you know, to get to the teaching. It's all kind of fascinating. Metta, M-E-T-T-A, is the word in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text for loving kindness. And somebody, how long ago was it? 3 weeks ago? A month ago? I can't remember. Sent me this email saying that basketball player Ron Artest, am I saying that right? Ron Artest was changing his name to Metta World Peace, which made me extremely happy because I didn't know who Ron Artest was. So then I had to look it up. So I've always wanted the word metta to enter popular culture, and it just never has. But maybe this will do it. Then there were all these articles all over the newspaper. One journalist wrote to me and said, have you had a very profound influence on his life? Because so many of my books have been about metta meditation. So he wrote and he said, have you had a very profound influence on his life? And I said, I don't think so. I never heard of him before. So I don't know how he chose the word or whatever. But I think of metta, aside from metta world peace, really as that quality of attention. So apart from the formal practice, when I think about bringing metta into my life, although sometimes it's kind of formal in that I will try to do the meditation, say, walking down the streets of New York or sitting on an airplane, something like that. That's also a very interesting experiment. I once made a resolve to do loving kindness or metta whenever I was waiting. So waiting online in the grocery store, waiting for an appointment. I count every mode of transportation as waiting to get to the other place. So that's the more formal, semi-formal application, and it's a fantastic thing to do. But I also just try to utilize attention. If I'm in conversation with somebody and I find myself sort of fragmented or distracted thinking about the next 50 emails I need to send, and not really paying attention to what they're saying, and I notice that, I do this, it's like the same mental gesture as the meditation practice. I try to gather my attention and actually listen and be there. That photo is the 17th Karmapa, who's also in Washington, D.C. just now. And a friend of mine once went to Sikkim to see the 16th Karmapa, his predecessor. And my friend returned to India, which is where we were living, and said that the 16th Karmapa, who is an extremely renowned, famous, well-known, highly regarded lama, greeted my friend as though his appearance there at his monastery was just about the most important thing that had ever happened to the Karmapa in his life. And he went on to say that he didn't convey that impression through great pomp and circumstance, but he conveyed that impression by paying absolute, complete attention to him. So that my friend said the subjective experience of that was one of feeling completely loved. And so I hold that model very much in my mind in terms of attention and loving kindness, whether it's casual conversation in an elevator in New York or a more intense conversation where still I can get distracted, one can get distracted, to really come back. And here too, I think, and this will be a theme that we'll work with throughout the weekend, is again, is everything that's implied in this ability to begin again. Maybe you do find yourself distracted in conversation, but you can start over, you can begin again. So that's the real practicality of the path. I think it's healing. You mean physically healing in that sense, or always?
Emotionally
healing. Okay, so I think that different aspects of meditation practice are emotionally healing in different ways, and they also all work together. To begin with, that concentration, that aspect of concentration, does provide a kind of centeredness, so that all the many emotions that come up do come up, but we have a quality of real centeredness. No, that's not distance, it's not icy and cold and removed, but it's also not being overcome by, enveloped by everything that comes up. And so it's almost like we know who we are in a way that gives us a lot of confidence and a kind of security or stability even in the face of all those changing states. And I think in terms of mindfulness, one of the functions of mindfulness is to allow us to see what we may be adding on to an experience, which is also very healing when we can let go of those add-ons. So the word, again, in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, is papancha. It means proliferation. What I heard one translator once refer to it as the imperialistic tendency of mind. So that something happens and the entire world is taken over. So I'll close with this last story, which is my favorite story to illustrate Papancha. I was teaching with my friend Joseph Goldstein somewhere, and we were just sitting in the kitchen of this place having tea, and someone came into the room in a state of some distress, and he said to Joseph, "I just had this really terrible experience while sitting." So Joseph said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "I felt all of this tension in my jaw, and I realized what an incredibly uptight person I am and how I always have been and I always will be." And Joseph said, "Oh, you mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw?" And he said, "Yes, and I've never been able to get close to people, and it's never going to change." And Joseph said, "You mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw?" And every time he said that, the guy would go on with a very elaborate story about everything it meant about him for the rest of his life. And every time the guy did that, Joseph would respond with, "You mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw?" It was really interesting for me watching him go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And finally, Joseph said something to him like, "Why are you adding a miserable self-image to a painful experience? It's like painful enough, genuinely so, to have that tension in your jaw, but then it becomes, this is what it's going to feel like tomorrow. This is what it's going to feel like next month. This is what it's going to feel like next year. This is what it means about me. It's never going to change." And we have taken an already painful experience and just piled on a lot of stuff. And so mindfulness helps us, first of all, see the distinction between the tension in our jaw and everything we're assuming about it for the future, and being able to let go of those add-ons. So that's a huge change, even though very difficult things may continue to arise. And then, of course, loving kindness or compassion is tremendously healing, because we're holding everything in a very different light, instead of with so much blame and feeling we should have been able to stop it or whatever it might be. There's a tremendous tenderness and kindness in even in the face of very difficult things. And so it's all really conducive to a kind of healing. So, okay, yeah, we actually do have time for one more. Yeah. I think it's a mix of things, too, and it takes a certain amount of self-scrutiny or honesty to... if it's an action, you know, if we've done something or said something, it takes a certain amount of reflection or understanding to see what our motivation was, in fact, and what we wanted out of that interaction, what our intention was, and to see if we've acted as skillfully as we might, if we said the thing we were saying as, you know, skillfully as it might have been said, or if we created the context, say, as skillfully or as well as we might have. And beyond that, there's often a kind of letting go. If we think, really, we've acted with some integrity or we've done the best we could. And it's not dismissing other people's reactions or saying we don't care, but there's just a certain kind of equanimity in realizing in the end... this is a part of life, that this is part of the nature of things, that people will have different kinds of reactions. I often think of, there's a cute little story about the Buddha, where he got someone all riled up against him. I forget what he was doing, actually. He was something like walking on a farmer's land, you know, or something like that, walking across this piece of land that belonged to the farmer, and the farmer got all angry and came up to him yelling and screaming and cursing, and the Buddha said something to the farmer like, "So, if you prepare a gift for somebody and you go to hand it to them and they won't take it, what happens to the gift?" And the farmer said, "Well, then it remains with me." And the Buddha said, "Just so, O farmer, I'm not receiving your gift of yelling and screaming and reviling and cursing. It's going to remain with you." And I've always liked that story. in a certain sense, which doesn't negate the need to have that kind of self-examination in terms of our action. Because we need that as well. We need to understand what we've done and what we wanted and how we've been, and were we sensitive, were we aware of the context in which we're acting. But at the same time, as we do that, we can also understand that if we were coming from a good place, if our intention was good, and we basically did the best that we could, that we need to have a kind of letting go. Because, sad to say, we can't control the universe and make it so that everyone responds appropriately to what we do or what we say or who we are. It's just not going to be that way. And it's really a deep question in terms of what does letting go really mean, you know, when it's not indifference and it's not coldness and it's not implying that you don't care and that you're withdrawn and pulling back, but it's really a measure of peace out of understanding this is the nature of things, this is how life is, that there will be misunderstandings, not everyone will get one another, that there's only so much you can do, and you must do that much. But beyond that, that's, you know, think of the farmer. Think of the Buddha. I mean, that's often how things are. It's in the nature of a life. And, you know, I'm sure we'll go into that much more over the weekend in terms of this teaching about praise and blame and getting what you want and not getting what you want, and in terms of human interaction or public interaction and what equanimity or peace actually is, that's different than indifference or not caring. Okay, now we have to stop. It's 9:00.